Nee, ja, dat lijkt wel. Zoals je bijbel is nu ook je best mee. What I will do is just for you to review, remember, it's not a test, you're not going to be great or anything. But I'm going to start up here at the front, and I'm going to let you name place by place the third journey. Now I'll start with Louise, where the third journey began. Antioch, that's right. Well, the next one is for the region. Is in the region of Phrygia, Galatia, and Phrygia. I'll give you those two. Well, he mentioned the fact that he went through the two regions back in the 18th chapter, beginning in verse 23. It says, after he had spent some time there, that is in Antioch, he departed and went over all the country of Galatia and Phrygia in order, strengthening all the disciples. The next mission you have him going somewhere is the next city. Where is that, Calvin? All right. Going back to Ephesus. And then Ephesus, where, JD?
Smyrna.
Yeah. Did we have Troas down? I think we put Troas down. He went across to Macedonia, but doesn't mention Troas. I think Macedonia was the next place. Then the next one, I think. Go down south. Yeah, that's back on the river.
Biggest hometown. Biggest hometown where biggest place of visit.
That was in Macedonia.
Where it played the biggest.
Yeah, that was in Macedonia. Seven this Philippi. Visit. Yeah, we didn't mention Philippi, did we? Until he comes back.
Come on.
Cindy, do you know? Karen? Probably in Corinth, you finally got there. It says Greece. I went down to Macedonia to Greece and spent 3 months in Greece. Actually, it was very likely in Corinth. The next one. No, he intended to sail back, you know, by ship and go to Caesarea, or to go to Syria, it says, but the Jews were laying in wait for him, so he had to go another route.
Greece?
No, it mentions one particular city from whence they left, and this is where the we section starts again. Philippi. And across from Philippi to where it murdered. Troas, where it faces that look.
I don't know.
What does it start with?
Yeah.
All right, Miletus. Miletus, where it may be. Nope.
Well,
yeah. That's the next one.
I don't know.
Sailed across to. Did you?
She got her third journey.
Third journey. Tyre. Tyre. And then to Ptolemais. Did not put Tyre. Yeah, but some of these are not mentioned. Some of these didn't mention because he didn't stay there. You know, I wrote that list down on the board, but didn't write it down on my paper.
You got some extra in there. I don't think you have
Tyre.
Don't make me up a code in there, and it don't work.
Put Tyre in there, unless it's confusing. You want to leave it off? You want to leave Tyre off?
Yeah.
All right, I leave Tyre off. He only spent a short time. Yeah, Miletus. He actually sailed from Miletus down across. He stopped at some other places just for a short time, even between Troas and Miletus, you see. But they were just bypasses.
Miletus and then Ptolemais.
Ptolemais. Yeah. And then Caesarea and then Jerusalem.
Right back on that boat.
Okay.
I guess it would just leave Gertie protected from you making it possible. The many churches were established and never written up.
I think so. I think there are a lot of Acts of the Apostles that are not even recorded in some of these congregations.
Perhaps even but Paul on his journey.
Yeah. I'm sure that's true. Now, the thing we need to do is to crystallize this list so we'll all have it uniform, so I know what to ask you and you know what to answer in the test.
They have to change my phone. Yeah.
Well, Jim, on my list,
they
got one from Galatians.
You got Galatia and Brazil reversed.
Do I? I don't, as long as you get them in there. Phrygia and Galatia.
Does that make a difference what order?
No. Not on that one.
Oh, I'm ready for that.
Not on those two. Now, the rest of them, it does. We better be accurate about this, so let's, it says Galatia and Phrygia. So let's get it right. Galatia, Phrygia, Ephesus. Did I put Troas down?
No.
No, I didn't. Macedonia.
Greece.
Macedonia. Did I put Greece or Corinth?
Greece.
Oh, this is another thing that's kind of confusing. It's a region, a town.
Yeah.
Philippi and Troy.
Well, they went to Macedonia, then they went back up in Macedonia again?
Yes, ma'am. He went across to Macedonia.
Troy.
It doesn't tell us any of the towns that he stopped there, but there are several towns in Macedonia. Philippi and Thessalonica, for instance, are both. Isn't Berea also in the in Macedonia? Then down into Greece, of course, then you run into Athens and Corinth. And very likely it was in particular in Greece at Corinth that he spent 3 months that he talked about. Then back up to Philippi. Now, why was the reason? Why didn't he sail across to Syria from Corinth? Well, that's possible.
What was your question?
Why didn't he sail across as he intended? Sail across from Corinth to Syria.
Because the Jews were after.
Or the Jews were laying in wait.
Because he had that money that he collected.
Very likely he had collected most of this. Now he might have collected some when he went back, but very likely he collected most of this. He intended to sail on across to Syria. But the Jews were laying in wait for him, so he went back up through Philippi. Who was that Philippi that you remember? Luke. Luke was left at Philippi, and he doesn't join the company until they come back through Philippi. Then in Troas, and from Troas, Miletus, and Miletus across to, I left out Tyre. Ptolemais. Caesarea. And then finally ending up in Jerusalem. That's the third journey. And this will be our crystallized list. That's the way we'll gather it.
You're going to leave Troas out?
No, I'll leave Tyre out.
I mean,
Troas out on the way up over here.
If I just put my coat on there, well, you know what I'm talking about.
No, you got to name the cities. Okay. You stuck over there in the corner.
Does this correspond to your list?
Yeah, I'm gonna write that list down.
I'm
gonna write it down. No, forget about that. We're not remembering all these places. If I were to ask you to remember all those places, all those little bitty towns, know that he stopped at, it'd make it too difficult.
No, but I mean on your outline, you only have one
Macedonia. Well, Philippi is in Macedonia.
So
that's the reason that the
yeah,
one's a province, the other is a town. Right. All right. Antioch, Galatia, Phrygia, Ephesus. Well, I thought I'd put it in, but then evidently I'd left it out, and so I didn't want to confuse people, so I'll make it easy for you and not put it in. Since it messed people's codes up and what they've already studied thus far.
I don't have any code.
But I'll give you credit for that. If I ask it on the test, you just get an automatic answer for it. I think you pronounce that Ptolemaeus, almost like it starts with a P. Just forget about the P, and the accent is on the A, Ptolemaeus. What's that? Jerusalem. I abbreviated it.
Is Phoenicia? Is Phoenicia a region, a smaller region in Syria?
Phoenicia sometimes is considered part of Syria and sometimes it's not, depending on how they were dividing it.
Lebanon,
the actual southern part of Syria.
Where cedars grew.
The way they're short on their mouth, it could be a little confusing.
That's the problem, you see. In some of these, as time passed, the boundaries would change, depending on who was ruling what territory. And Syria, at one time, actually extended all the way down the coast, even including Israel. All of Israel.
Israel down to Jordan.
Yeah. All right. Do you have all that down now? That'll help you, maybe. Now, close your Bible back up if you have it. And we're going to review from the 16th chapter. I'm going to take about 5 minutes and review chapter 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20. All right, if you want to take notes, that's all right. I'm going to, again, let each of you take a chapter. And I'll just call on you at random. So that you'll just tell me everything you know, the main characters, the numbers, and the places. In each chapter. Sharon, chapter 16.
Don't
want
that.
No. What journey?
Second
journey. What place? Yeah, but actually, right now we're getting into what city? Well, the latter part of chapter 15 begins with second journey. Now, when he comes to the early part of the 16th chapter, then he's in 2 pounds. Right. Lystra. No. That's back in the 13th chapter.
He goes in there.
Picks up Timothy. All right. Then they go on from there to where? All right, then from there on, we didn't have Iconium down on the list. Did we?
No.
Now don't confuse the first journey with this.
The second journey?
Yeah, this is the second journey. That's what you said to start with.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't know. All right, Troas. Look out the window over here. Then from Troas to where? Well, the whole 16th chapter deals primarily around one town and the events in one town. Where's that town, Bob? No, that was the Troas where you got called to go to Macedonia. Now, the province of Macedonia is the province in which that town is. And I'm talking about Now you got 17 and 18 chapters. Where's it, Jesse Lee?
I said.
No. Well, we're going to have to straighten y'all out.
Okay. Philippi. Yeah, I'm giving him. I had a woman was baptized there.
Yeah, you got a woman by the name of Lydia, who was a seller of purple, whose heart the Lord opened, who was meeting down by the riverside in prayer with the other women. And she was baptized with her household. Then immediately you have another young woman possessed with a demon. Paul cast the demon out of the lady, which caused conflict with her masters, who in turn accused Paul and Silas, caused them to be beaten and cast into prison, where you come into contact with another conversion, which is the
jailer.
That's right, in his household. And then this brings to an end the events in Philippi. And from Philippi, they go, and the 17th chapter begins to talk about the other places, from Philippi down into, what's the next town? Kelso, chapter 17.
Athens.
No, that's not, that's two towns away yet. Thessalonica. All right, in Thessalonica, then you're going to have the main characters of Paul and Silas, and then the Timothy is with the company, it doesn't mention it. But preaching, of course, in the synagogue, and there's one number here, let me see, is it number 3? Yes, number 3. What does that number bring to your mind? Thessalonica, number 3. Reason 3 Sabbath days. And of course, the Jews stirred up the people. Paul had to leave Thessalonica, and the next town was Berea. And in particular, the thing you want to remember about Berea?
They were going home on this
day. All right. That's the important thing about the Bereans. Then, of course, the Jews from Thessalonica come down, and they stir up the people in Berea. And Paul has to escape from Berea. And from there, he goes down to the next city where Kelso wants us to get. And that's in Athens. What do you remember about the situation in Athens, Kelso?
Well, one thing I remember about this image that I set up, if they had some money, Paul used a very good way to people. Sure, they might leave out one.
Okay. And, of course, there were some very good points that Paul made in the midst of the Areopagus. You need to remember that word, the Areopagus, which in some translations had it Mars heel. The Areopagus, because there was a man, Dionysius, who was an Areopagite, a member of the council of the Areopagus, which is a particular council. All right. Then, as Paul finishes his lesson here, the 18th chapter takes us into what town next? Betty. Nadine. Corinth. Right. And what do you remember about Corinth? Okay, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians were written from Corinth.
Okay.
This is later on. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? But that's on the third journey. Yeah. It's on the third journey. You see, on the third journey, while he was in Ephesus, was the time that he wrote 1st and 2nd Corinthians. Then he went across the Macedonia down into Greece, and actually in Corinth, at the same time that he wrote Romans and Galatians. Now, chapter 18, verse 24, he starts the third journey. All right, at Corinth, there are two people there, a man and his wife, that you're going to need to remember. All right, Priscilla and Aquila. And they were tent makers by occupation. So those are characters in the 18th chapter. Another character you'll need to remember, well, chapter 18 and verse 8 is Crispus. And what do you associate Crispus with? Chief ruler of the synagogue, one of the chief rulers of the synagogue to be converted. But then chapter 18 concludes with, or in the middle part of chapter 18, you're dealing with a man by the name of Gallio. And what do you remember him for? All right. Was he a Jew?
No.
He was a ruler in Corinth. And the Jews, of course, brought Paul before him. And what accusation did they make against Paul before Gallio?
He was speaking against the law. And Gallio said he didn't care for those things. If it's a matter of wickedness, villainy is not what courts are open. But if it's disputes about names in their own law,
And then, of course, another ruler of the synagogue, we find him in a different situation. What's his name? Corinth. Sosthenes. He's beaten. All right. Then,
how do you establish he was?
Just by inference, really. I don't know why the Jews would beat him. Of course, the Jews' religion was what was being attacked. And here's the root of the synagogue, so it would hold their religion up to public ridicule for them to beat their own leader, you see. Whereas, on the other hand, when you see Gallio's response, then the response of the Greek people who were not Jews would be a retaliation against the Jews. So that's, to me, that's the inference that I get from it. And of course, it could be possible the other way, but it doesn't seem to fit the other way to me. All right, chapter 18 and verse... the Greeks. Yes, he was a Roman ruler. All right, then the second journey ends in the 18th chapter and verse 22. Now, it would have made it a lot easier if they divided these chapters up according to journeys. That way you could say, well, the 18th chapter ends with a second journey. But in the 23rd verse of the 18th chapter, you have Luke recording the beginning of the third journey as, from Corinth. We better get these other places in here so you don't get confused. From Corinth, he went down to, or went or sailed across to Ephesus. And he left Aquila and Priscilla in Ephesus and sailed on to Caesarea, went up and saluted the church, evidently in Jerusalem, and then went back to Antioch. Now, in about two verses there, he covers Ephesus, Caesarea, Jerusalem, Antioch, and then back to Ephesus on the third journey, you see. So our third journey began in Antioch in chapter 18 and verse 23. And he takes you through the areas of Galatia and Phrygia, and then immediately back to the city in Ephesus, where Paul is going to stay for quite some time. Now, he didn't stay in Ephesus the first time when he was there, on the second journey, because he was in a hurry to get back to Jerusalem, you see. And now Luke brings him back to Ephesus, and he's going to stay in Ephesus for some time. How long?
3 years.
3 years. 3 years. How long had he stayed in Corinth before?
Year and a half.
18 months, year and a half. You'll need to remember those numbers. Was it in Ephesus 2 years? Let me see. I can check just a moment and find out. Chapter 20 and verse 31, when he speaks to the Ephesian elders, he says, "Therefore watch and remember that by the space of 3 years I cease not to warn everyone night and day with tears." So it's 3 years in Ephesus. All right. Now, on the third journey, we've gotten back as far as Ephesus. And he stayed in Ephesus until what happened caused him to leave?
Just a funeral appearance over the shelves.
Who caused that? Demetrius. All right. How long were are they in the theater crying, "Great is thy enemy, the goddess of the Ephesians"? Yeah. 2 hours. What Jew was put forth and tried to speak but was not allowed to speak, and this actually brought the shouting?
Alexander. Oh boy, these coppersmiths are nuts. That might have got him in trouble if he was a coppersmith, but all those silversmiths.
I guess he could have. All right, from Ephesus, then he travels across to the next place we have is Macedonia. And then, of course, from Macedonia down into Greece, which actually is Corinth. And he decides that he's going to sail from Corinth, as we've mentioned, to Syria, but he's not able to because some of the Jews are laying wait for him. Now, keep in mind, this is the time that he's collecting this gift for the saints in Jerusalem. Now, what books talk about this that you can think of?
Romans.
All right. Romans, in the 15th chapter particularly, talks about it. Is Paul concerned about the reception of this gift by the Jewish brethren in Jerusalem?
Yes.
Yes, he asks them to pray that the Jews will receive it. And, of course, in 2 Corinthians, chapters 8 and 9, as well as 1 Corinthians 16, he mentions this gift and the collection of it, particularly to the church of Corinth, that they need to be ready. The other churches have already done. The churches in Achaia have already accomplished this and given beyond their means in Macedonia and Achaia. And now they need to be ready to fulfill their part. So he takes the gift with certain messengers who have been selected. And I'm not going to ask you to remember the names of Sopater and all these other fellows who were accompanying the gift. But then he goes back to Philippi. He picks Luke up in Philippi, and the we section begins. And then from Philippi, he sailed across to Troas. Now, Troas is important because in Troas, in the early part of chapter 20, now we covered the 19th chapter primarily dealing with the events in Ephesus. Now, remember the chapters according to the places. Chapter 19 deals almost exclusively with Ephesus. But chapter 20, he's gone all the way through Macedonia and Greece and come back to Philippi and now to Troas. As he sailed, he waits 5 days, and then 7 days he tarries there until what time? It was the first of the Sabbaths, is actually the Greek reads, the first day of the week. And he meets with the disciples here for what purpose? Why are they assembling together on the first day of the week?
Break
bread. What is the breaking of bread? Lord's Supper. The common phrase used in reference to the Lord's Supper. We've got to hasten on. Alright, from chapter 20 then, in Troas, he sails down to the next town of importance is Miletus. And here he sends for the Ephesian elders. And a lot of the 20th chapter is in Miletus, his final address to the Ephesian elders. And of course, there are several points he makes to these Ephesian elders, primarily that they need to be watchful, they need to be on guard, because grievous wolves, he says, shall enter in, not sparing the flock. Even from among your own selves, some men arise speaking perverse things and lead away disciples after themselves. And then, of course, his departure from him is very sorrowful and tearful. And he comes down into the next town that we have listed. I didn't list Tyre, but Ptolemais. And I'm not going to ask you to remember too much about these cities. The ones that we picked out, Tyre and Ptolemais both had disciples. They had to look for disciples in Tyre. Then Ptolemais, they were sent off by the disciples from Ptolemais and down to Caesarea. And what happens in Caesarea? Who did they meet in Caesarea? That's actually our lesson beginning tonight, isn't it? All right, Agabus is a prophet, one of the prophets. And there's another man in Caesarea. Philip?
And the four daughters
that prophesied. Who else do you remember that might well have been a part of the church in Caesarea?
This old man.
What I'm thinking about wasn't too old. I don't think so. Several chapters ago.
Oh, you talked about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Parnius was a resident of Caesarea. You've forgotten that, have you? Too long ago.
Well, he might have died or something.
All right, now we're ready to begin the 21st chapter. Now, I've taken 30 minutes of time to review all this to try to get us straightened out. Well, we might try again later. And it came to pass that after we were gotten from them and had launched, we came with a straight course unto Cus, or Kos, however you want to pronounce it, the day following unto Rhodes, and thence from Tyre or Petra, and finding a ship sailing over in unto Phoenicia, we went aboard and set forth. Now, I didn't ask you to remember all those places. I could have, but I figured you were confused enough. And they just stopped these places temporarily, so we just were bypassing them. Now, when we had discovered Cyprus, and who do you remember that was from Cyprus? Barnabas was from Cyprus. Paul, you remember Paul and Barnabas had drawn across on the first journey to a little town called Salamis, and then to Paphos, both on the island of Cyprus. They left it on the left hand and sailed into Syria and landed at Tyre. Well, there the ship was to unlade her burden. And finding the disciples, we tarried there 7 days. Why did he tarry there 7 days? All right, that's very possible. Very, very possible too. That's how long the ship was there. They were kind of slaves, you see, to the schedule of the ship. And so, whenever it was to unlay its burden, then they were to head on from that period of time. And when we had accomplished those days, we departed and went our way, and they all brought us on our way, and with wives and children, till we were out of the city, and we kneeled down on the shore and prayed. Now, we missed a lot of this. Did I skip verse 4?
Well, I read verse 4. And finding the disciples, we tarried there 7 days.
Yeah. All right, I skipped the latter part of verse 4. That's right. Who said to Paul through the Spirit, that he should not go up to Jerusalem. Now, that's the question.
Yes, I was about to overlook that. Thank you, J.D.
The question I asked was Paul disobeying the Spirit? Is this saying that the Spirit was forbidding Paul to go to Jerusalem?
Well, I think it is that the Spirit simply revealed to these people what would happen to Paul. Same thing back verse in chapter 20, verse 23. The Spirit had already revealed Paul with the bond of society. This is just another instance where possibly the Spirit of these people had been warned by the Spirit, or they had this special knowledge, miraculous knowledge of what was going to happen. So it would be a warning rather than a direct order from the Spirit, not still.
I think what happens as you view it in other contexts, every city that he goes through, there are people who have gifts of the Spirit, particular prophecy. Now, what do these prophets know? They're prophesying to Paul, as he says, every city that I've gone through, that what awaits me in Jerusalem? Bonds. Now, how do the disciples react to this? Don't go. We don't want you to go, you see. So this has to be understood. Well, for instance, in verse 11, the same chapter, it says, when he was come unto us, he took Paul's girdle, that is his belt, and bound his own hands and feet, and said, thus saith the Holy Ghost, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man who owneth this girdle, and shall deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. And this is what the Spirit was prophesying in these prophets, that Paul was going to be bound. Paul knew that was going to happen. But then the attitude of the people was, don't go. So this verse has to be understood in the light of the others that relate to the same subject. And we'll find this is very important on another subject when we cross-reference verses that they're going to be in chapter 21. Well, I think these disciples had to have the Spirit. For instance, it says, who said to Paul, through the Spirit, you see, it was by the inspiration of the Spirit that they said this. And the only gift that would allow them to do it would be the gift of prophecy, which could foresee this event, you see. All right, let's see. Then the verse, I was mentioning verse 5, that we sometimes read through a lot of these scenes without really understanding, without putting ourselves in their place. And if we understand sometimes that we're about to say goodbye to somebody that we'll never see again, we realize that. That is, he said to the Ephesian elders that you won't ever see my face again. And this, of course, caused a lot of sorrow. So every town that he goes into, the prophets, those who say through the Spirit,
that you're going to be bound. The Jews are going to deliver you to the Gentiles. You're going to be bound, and we're not going to see you anymore. Now, this is what they understand. And so they're sorrowing because of this. And time again, the scenes are very touching, moving scenes, because they're scenes of sorrow, and as Paul is departing and seeing the disciples for the last time. All right, then in verse 7, and when we had finished our course, well, verse 6, and when we had taken our leave one of another, we took ship, and they returned home again. And when we had finished our course from Tyre, we came to Ptolemais, and saluted the brethren, and abode with them one day. And the next day, we that were of Paul's company departed. You see, Luke says, we that were of Paul's company, and came unto Caesarea, and we entered into the house of Philip the evangelist. Now, where do you remember Philip?
6, 6.
Chapter 6 is where it begins. Chapter 8 is where you see him the last time. That's right. He's in Samaria, and then he preaches to the Ethiopian eunuch. And then you don't see him again. He passes through these cities, and you don't see him again until
he... He was one of the men that was chosen there to take care of the neglected widows.
That's right. Chapter 6.
First time.
One of the seven. That's the reason he specified he's one of the seven.
Was he a deacon?
Yes, in the sense of ministry. That's a loaded question.
Roy Cargill said you can call him one if you want to. he won't say he's one. He said you can call him one if you want to.
Well, that was the work he was doing. It actually calls him a diakonos, a minister, to take care of these affairs.
He had to do the work when he had to have it.
Yeah. All right. The same man had four daughters. There's another number. In other words, if I say four, then you immediately think of chapter 21 and verse 9.
You want to say four daughters.
Oh, that's that daughter.
So that's seven there.
That's right. One of the seven. And as we tarried there many days, there came down from Judea a certain prophet named Agabus. Who remembers Agabus before this?
Yep.
Seven. What did Agabus prophesy there?
Famine
down in Judea. That's right. It's unusual. Agabus stands out. Now, there were other prophets, you see, other prophets among the disciples who in town to town had prophesied about what was going to happen. But it seems like there's some of them who have more ability or more power in the Spirit than others do. Now, why, I don't know. But Agabus is singled out. He came down from Judea. And when he was come unto us, he took Paul's girdle. Now, that was a good word in the King James translation back in 1611. Doesn't mean the same thing today. So don't think that Paul was wearing a girdle like women sometimes wear. But this was a belt. Many times a hollow belt that they would, they carried their money in. And they made a hollow and put their money in it and then gird themselves around with this belt. So he took Paul's belt and bound his own hands and feet and said, thus saith the Holy Ghost, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man that owneth this girdle, or this belt, and shall deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. So Paul knew from the express statements of the Spirit exactly what was going to happen. And when we heard these things, both we and they of that place besought him not to go up to Jerusalem. Now you see how that corresponds back with verse 4? This explains verse 4. The Spirit was revealing that this was what was going to happen. Who did the beseeching? The Spirit didn't do the beseeching. The disciples did the beseeching. They heard what the Spirit said through the prophets. Then they besought Paul that he would not go. Then Paul answered, what mean you to weep and to break mine heart? For I am ready not to be bound only, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. Now Paul didn't know what was going to happen beyond Jerusalem. He knew that he was to appear before kings, but this was a vague thing, and I don't think he understood fully what was to happen. So he says, I'm ready to die. Now, the problem is not that I'm concerned about myself, but he was concerned about these disciples, and their sorrowing was what was breaking his heart. It was bearing him down because they were so sorrowful about him. And when he would not be persuaded, we ceased saying, the will of the Lord be done. That is, whatever the Lord wants will occur. And after those days, we took up our carriages. How do you carry a carriage?
They
just pick your luggage up and go take off. There went with us also certain of the disciples of Caesarea, and brought with them one Mason of Cyprus, an old disciple, with whom we should lodge. That was the person you were thinking about, Calvin. Yeah. And when we have come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. Now, what do you remember? How do you think Paul would react to this? You see, he was concerned, as he wrote Romans 15 and 2 Corinthians, about the reception of this gift. So now he comes to Jerusalem, and we can't, it doesn't tell us in the text, but there is some apprehension on the part of Paul about how this gift is going to be received from these Gentile churches. But they receive us gladly, Luke says. And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present, and when they had saluted him, he declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles by his ministry. And of course, they realized that Paul's primary work was among the Gentiles, whereas theirs, Peter, James, and John, and the other apostles, was dealing primarily with the Jews. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, Thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they're zealous of the law. Now immediately Paul is faced with another problem. Now all these Jews that are zealous about the law, and it says, and they are informed of thee, who do you reckon did the informing? Probably Jews did the informing. Accusations against Paul. They informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles. Now, where had Paul been working? Not in the area of Judea and Jerusalem, you see, where the Jews made up most all of every community. But in Asia, in Macedonia, and over in Greece, where the Jews are in the minority and they dwell amongst the Gentiles. So the rumor has come to us that you're teaching all these Jews who are living amongst the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the custom. That verse there is important to our understanding why Paul is going to go into the temple and to pay for the price, evidently, of the sacrifices to continue in this vow these four men have taken, what the apostles James suggests, the others suggest, as being perfectly legitimate according to the Scripture and according to what Paul taught both in Romans and in Galatians. So keep in mind that the accusation deals with two things. Number one, circumcision. And we understand that when you go in amongst the Jews who are living in the Gentiles or amongst the Gentiles, that you're teaching them that they are not supposed to circumcise their children. And point number two, they are not to walk after the customs. Let's use that word, customs. Customs of Moses. Now, Moses understood, forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise the children. So these two things are involved in what they're talking about in forsaking Moses. Circumcising the children and the walk after the customs of the law. And the reason I said that's very important, because we're going to find another statement which has to be synonymous with that statement, in reference to what Paul is going to do. Now, what have we established thus far in what Paul is doing as he goes amongst the Jews? Paul, he says in 1 Corinthians, became a Jew to Jews. Now, he could not become a Jew in a religious sense, in the which he taught that a man must keep the law to be saved, or in the which he allowed men to believe that they had to keep the law to be justified. Now, that was a contrary purpose of the law, and Paul taught that this was wrong for man to teach that. On the other hand, there were things that, from the time of Moses and even back before the time of Moses and Abraham, the circumcision, for instance, and the passing of time, that there were customs that had become a part of their nation. This is the way Jews live, you see. Now, did Paul teach men that they were not to circumcise their children? No, sir. He had Timothy circumcised, you see. Did Paul teach men that they were not to walk according to the Jewish customs? No. What did he teach men? That they were not to bind the law, that they were not under the law, that they could not be justified by the law. Now, that's very important. Keep that in mind. Now, let's read on. In verse 22, What is it therefore? The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. Alright, now these are going to, we're going to have a crisis here. We need to avert the crisis because these are going to come together when they hear that you're here and they've heard about what you're supposed to talk. Do therefore this that we say to thee. Now we propose a plan we think that will solve the problem. Or we have four men which have a vow on them. Then take and purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. Keepest the law how? Kept the law as justification, kept the ordinances of the law as a system of purification, sacrifice for sin. No. I said it's very important in reference to the statements made here because those statements are synonymous with what he concludes down here. Now the people have heard that you teach that they are to forsake Moses. How? Forsake Moses in teaching them not to circumcise their children and not walking according to the customs. Now, that's what they mean. That's what James means here by the keeping of the law. That here, as he comes down, he says, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. That is, you teach men that is perfectly acceptable for them to circumcise their children and to keep the customs of the law, you see. But not, I think it must be inferred, not that they have to keep the law to be justified, nor that they can keep the law as a system of religious justification. You see that contrast? Everyone's silent. Must mean they don't.
Yeah, it's not so much.
Okay.
Or there's two ways you can keep the law.
That's right.
Religiously, or you can keep it as a matter of custom.
That's right. Can you see what kind of a drastic change it would be for a Jew who had kept these customs all of his life? He wore certain kinds of apparel. He conducted himself according to a certain fashion. There were some things that were naturally unclean to him. Certain animals, he still wouldn't eat because this is what he had done all of his life as a Jew. Now, the Jewish system was both a national system and a religious system. There were some things that they would continue doing nationally as Jews, customs of the law. And Paul never taught that they had to forsake those. The thing he taught that they could not bind and they could not believe was that the system of the law of Moses could justify, that sacrifices, the law of Moses could forgive sins. Because then that would be a violation of what Christ did and the very purpose for which they live. Now, it would be wrong for them to bind these customs on Gentile Christians and say, as some of them have said, you've got to be circumcised before you can be saved. No, sir, that's not right. Man can't do that. Paul had already had that conflict in Acts the 14th and Acts the 15th chapter, you see. All right. This is a good point to stop right here, I guess. Let me read verse 25 and then we'll stop. Start with verse 26. As touching the Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols and from blood and from strangled and from fornication. And that was back in the 15th chapter, you remember. Now, this is the only thing that we've asked the Gentiles to do. You see, living amongst Jewish Christians as they're associated together. But they don't do these things. Now, there are other things that Jewish people, Jewish Christians, would do that they don't have any right to bind on the Gentile. But as customs, they can continue doing them when they realize that these are not important to the justification of men's souls. That's the whole point of this comment. And if you read anything else into it, you're going to get into trouble. Because what two epistles has Paul already written in which he deals with the law and shows that it is not binding on men today? Right. Romans and Galatians. Both of these epistles deal primarily with a contrast between the system of faith in Jesus Christ and the system of justification by works of law, the law of Moses, you see. So he can't practice one thing or teach one thing and practice something else. He's got to be consistent. It would have been wrong for him if he had been doing this as a system of justification, as religious acts in reference to a part of the law instead of the customs of the law. It would have been wrong for him to do so. All right, let's stop there and we'll get a drink of water and we'll start with verse 26.
That's all experience I've had.
Okay, let's begin now in verse 26. Paul is in the temple. He took the men, the next day purifying himself with them, entered into the temple. Now, reading from what we see of, for instance, the Nazarite vow, Numbers chapter 6, evidently, they might have begun a vow, but have come into contact with some dead body, which has necessitated that they go through a process of purification and the beginning of the vow again. So this is a system of purification, not the completion of the vow, but the system of purification. Paul now has not been exposed in any way to make himself impure. It takes only one day, for instance, in his purification. So his purification is accomplished in one day, until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him. Why the Jews of Asia?
They're the ones that always give him the trouble.
They're the ones, you see, where Paul did most of his preaching.
Where did it?
In Asia, up in Asia. They were the ones who knew about Paul. They'd been exposed to him time and time again in their cities, you see, in their synagogues. So they were now in Jerusalem for the feast day, and they stirred the people up and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man which teacheth, or that teacheth all men everywhere, against the people and the law in this place, and further brought Greeks also into the temple, and hath polluted this holy place." That is, he defiled this holy place by bringing a Greek into it. What Greek did Paul take into the temple?
He didn't take anybody in there.
Yeah. The process of purifying the temple was a very lengthy, detailed one. And any time a Greek was taken into the actual sanctuary of the temple, it defiled the temple. Here was a man who was unclean by the Jewish standards. And so they had to go through a whole process of purification. And it was a very detailed process. Alright, in verse 29, "For they had seen before him in the city Trophimus, an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple." Now, that's not very good evidence, is it? You see a man together with another man a day or two before that, and then you make an accusation that he's brought this man to the temple. They didn't see him in there, but they just supposed that this had happened. "And all the city was moved, and the people ran together, and they took Paul and drew him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut." Now keep in mind that this is at the time of the feast, and there are multitudes of Jews in Jerusalem. There's a whole bunch of them. "And as they went about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar." Now these people have really stirred the city up. If you wanted to disturb a Jew, if you wanted to upset a Jew, then make an accusation that here was a man who was teaching things contrary to what they believed, and furthermore, that he had defiled the temple. There's an instance in the Old Testament in which Antiochus, if I remember the name right, when he besieged Jerusalem and captured it, to show his disgust for the Jewish system, he took a pig's ear and pig's blood into the temple and smeared it all over the temple. Can you imagine how a Jew would react to that? First of all, a pig was unclean. And to take it into the temple and spread the pig's blood over the holy place, that is
a height. That's a very zenith of men. So.
Yeah. And I don't know how he could defile the temple any more than that. So this was a means of really stirring them up, defile the temple. All right? "The chief captain then, of course, of the band, that all Jerusalem was in an uproar, who immediately," this chief captain, and he's the technical term for him is a chiliarch, who immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down unto them. And when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. Now, Paul wouldn't have stood a chance if this man hadn't come. They were in the process of killing him. They knew what they were doing, and Paul evidently knew what was going to happen too. So if this man hadn't come, then they would have continued beating him and would have killed him. But now they see him come. How many men do you think might have accompanied this Heliarch? Well, that's how many men he was over. That's right. But we don't know whether he took all of his 1,000 or not, but it says it took his cohorts, or he took cohorts. How many is that? That's 100. So at least there were 200 men with him, you see. Now, that's a lot of men. But when you find that there are thousands and thousands of Jews who are in a mob, and one man in the center of the mob, and they're all trying to get to him, and they're just filled with anger and indignation, they're trying to kill him, it's going to take some show of power before they're going to stop that.
Kind of wonder where the rest of Paul's company is here. Are they up to them too? Probably are.
What about the 4 men, you see, they were in the temple with him? What happened to them?
They're probably after them too.
Could be. Or it could be that their attention is so centered around Paul, he's singled out, you see, as the man who's teaching this. So they might have just left the others in the background and centered their attention on Paul. Then the chief captain came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with 2 chains and demanded who he was and what he had done. But he doesn't get a satisfactory answer because from the multitude some are crying one thing and some another. And when he could not know the certainty for the tumult, the disturbance, he commanded him to be carried into the castle, that is, was into the garrison or into the fort. This was the abiding place of the barracks. That'd be a good definition of the Heliarch. And when he came up on the stairs, so it was that he was borne of the soldiers for the violence of the people. It seems like they had a hard time getting away from him. And Paul, if you can just imagine how he was, he'd been beaten. Now, we don't know how long he'd been beaten, but it took a few minutes for the soldiers and the Heliarch to get there. And he's bruised and beaten, and maybe he can't walk, and he may well be dazed. And so the soldiers just pick him up and bear him along because of the violence of the people to get him away from them. Now, can you imagine people who are supposed to be religious people acting that way?
The worst kind when they get learned up.
Yeah.
Like North Island.
Yeah. I guess it'd be very similar to that.
Killed him all that.
Then verse 36, for the multitude of the people followed after, crying, away with him. And as Paul was to be led into the castle, he said unto the chief captain, may I speak unto thee? Who said, canst thou speak Greek? And then Paul spoke to him in Greek. And he says, well, can you speak Greek? He's a Jew, you see. He recognizes that. Art thou not that Egyptian? Who did the Heliarch think he was? Well, he thought he was that Egyptian. Josephus records story about an Egyptian, and he says he led away some 30,000 men. Here, this Heliarch says, which before these days made us an uproar, and led us out into the wilderness 4,000 men that were murderers.
Felt like Josephus.
Yeah, he has a tendency to do that. He's not very reliable as a historian in some respect. But I suppose this was the only man that the Heliarch could think of. You know this man's name? I'm going to quit calling him a Heliarch and refer to him by name. Claudius Lysias. Does that sound right?
Yes. Because he writes the letter and he puts his name.
He signs his name Claudius Lysias. So we'll call him Old Claude or Lysias or something like that. So you'll remember who he is.
Call him Lys.
Lys? You might remember him better by Claude. But Paul said, I am a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, a city of no mean city. Does he mean by that Tarsus might have been accused of being a mean, bad city?
No. It wasn't insignificant or obscure.
All right. Again, that's one of those negative points. He could have said that it's a city of good repute, but he said it's a city that it's a no mean city. So I beseech thee, suffer me to speak unto the people. And when he had given him license, that is, opportunity, time, leave, permission, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with the hand of the people, and when there was a great silence, he spake to them in the Hebrew tongue, saying. Now he spoke to the Heliarch in Greek, because this man was Greek-speaking Roman. But when he begins to address the Jews, he speaks in the Hebrew tongue. Men and brethren, this begins chapter 22. you want to put a title for this chapter, it's Paul's first defense. That's a good way to remember him, his first defense before the Jews. Now keep in mind the setting. They've caught him in the temple. They take him outside the temple, they shut the doors of the temple. And evidently in the court of the Gentiles, they're all thronged together, multitudes of Jews. And they're in the process of beating Paul with the intent of killing him. And Claude comes along with his soldiers and takes him by force, and now he's taking him back to the fort. And evidently this first defense takes place as Paul may well be standing on the steps of the garrison of the fort. And so he begins, "Men and brethren, fathers, hear ye my defense, which I make now unto you." Now, I'm not going to spend much time in talking about this, because all Paul does is go back over his rearing, his birthplace, his background as a Jew, and his conversion. We've talked about all this already. So you are familiar with this. He tells us what he's done. He tells us how he had persecuted the disciples and how he saw the light on the road to Damascus. The light shone round about him. He went to Damascus. Ananias came to him and told him what to do. Verse 22 is very important. You need to remember that one. Chapter 22, verse 16 is the one I want you to memorize. Perhaps you know it already. "Ananias said, Why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized, and wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord." This was the instruction given by Ananias. Then he tells about what took place. He comes back to Jerusalem, and in a trance, in verse 18, "And saw him saying unto me, Make haste and get thee quickly out of Jerusalem, for they will not receive thy testimony concerning me." Now, you see how much time has been covered by what Paul has said? From his birthplace, his rearing at the feet of Gamaliel. He mentions the fact later on that he was there in Jerusalem when they stoned Stephen. He went to Damascus. The light shone round about him on the way. He was converted to Damascus. Ananias told him what to do. He doesn't mention the 3 years that he went away into Arabia. Then back to Damascus. Preached and escaped by night, being led over the wall by a basket. And now he's back in Jerusalem again. And he's there to preach to them, but the Lord says they won't receive your testimony. So, he tells them to get out. "And I said to the Lord, They know that I am imprisoned and beat in every synagogue them that believed on thee. And when the blood of thy martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by and consenting unto his death, and kept the raiment of them that slew him. And he said unto me, Depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the Gentiles." Now so far they've listened to what Paul had to say. But the word Gentile sets them off again. Now they just can't stand that. Just almost like defiling the temple. And in verse 22, "And they gave him audience unto this word, and then lifted up their voices and said, Away with such a fellow from the earth, for it is not fit that he should live." Now that's a pretty strong statement to make. He's not even worthy that he should live anymore. All he's good for is dying. And you take him away, he shouldn't even be alive. "Then the chief captain," or verse 23, "and as they cried out, they cast off their clothes." That doesn't mean that they cast them all off, but perhaps the outer garments, as an expression of anguish, anger, and threw dust into the air. Can you imagine a scene like that? Grown men standing around picking dust, throwing up in the air, and rending their garments and throwing their garments off.
I've seen cattle like that.
Yeah, I thought about that. You seen an old bull? When he gets mad, he puts his paw down, you know, he throws that dust back. Boy, he's angry.
We drove through the hospital one time, and the prison was cleaning the street. And that's the first time I ever saw that. They would pick up a shovel full of this sand, throw it away, and the wind was blowing hard.
Yeah.
It's fine. Yeah. They didn't care about that dirt. Nah.
Well, these men are about like that, I guess. They're just an expression of anger and frustration and anger.
Extreme.
Yeah. "The chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle and bathed, that he should be examined by scourging." Now, that's a peculiar way of putting that. How are you going to examine a man by scourging? You're going to beat him until he talks. That's what you're going to do.
Get a confession out of it.
That's right. One way or the other, you're going to find out what's going on. So this was what they were about to do. And that he might know whereof they cried so against him. He didn't know what was going on, you see. Okay. Verse 25, and as they bound him with thongs, Paul said unto the centurion that stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned? Where had Paul before mentioned his Roman citizenship? That's right. When they had been beaten and put into prison, you know, and the next day they sent for him and said, well, you can go now. You see? Paul said, no. He said, you've beaten us publicly and uncondemned. Then let them come and take us out of the prison. So this is back in the 16th chapter, the part of chapter 16. When the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief captain, saying, take heed what thou doest, for this man is a Roman. Do you know what Claude says later on about this? Yeah, but there's another interesting point. We might just wait. Let's see. I don't know what... Well, let's just wait, because we need to get through the 23rd chapter, and that's in the 23rd chapter. We'll bring it up. Yeah, we'll bring it up over there. All right, then the chief captain came and said, tell me, art thou Roman? He said, yea. That means yes. You bet I am. And the chief captain answered, with a great sum obtained I this freedom. And Paul said, but I was freeborn. Now, they're both Roman citizens. But one was freeborn, and the other says I had to pay for mine. This Roman citizenship was very important. It brought a lot of benefits from it. One of which was that you couldn't be bound to be beaten. You couldn't be beaten uncondemned. You had to have a trial. You had to be condemned for it. And even then, they had a hard time beating you after you'd been condemned for a crime. Yes, Calvin.
You got hit on the black market.
Yeah, that's very possible.
Paul was a native. Our law is based on Roman law.
Mm-hmm. Now, what does this do between Paul and Claude? Establishes some rapport, doesn't it? Some agreement, some common thing they have together. That's right. So that means old Claude is going to look out for Paul, you see. He's going to be concerned about Paul and Paul's welfare.
He brags about it a little bit, but he still takes care of Paul.
Yeah, that's over in the 23rd chapter. All right, then straightway they departed from him, which should have examined him. They're not going to beat him now. He's a Roman. They know better than that. And the chief captain also was afraid after he knew that he was a Roman and because he'd bound him. Not because he put him in chains back over yonder when they were taking him captive, but because they'd bound him and were in the process almost of beating him. And so he was afraid because he might get in trouble for that. On the morrow, because he would have known the certainty wherefore he was accused of the Jews, he loosed him from his bands and commanded the chief priest and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. Now, you remember chapter 22, because this is Paul's first defense. And like I said, evidently this is on the steps of the garrison. Now, chapter 23 is Paul's second defense before the Jews, but also before the council. Ananias is present, the high priest at this time. So chapter 23 is the second defense. Now, I'm not going to give you any more question sheets from here on, for several reasons, one of which is I couldn't keep up with it. I couldn't make out all these questions beforehand. Another is because there are not that many important questions to ask. We're dealing with places and events, and it's just carrying us right on through the last few years of Paul's life. All right, chapter 23 begins, and Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. Well, the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Here's a man who's being very impudent. He's standing before us, and he's accused, and he ought to be humble before us. And here he says, I've lived in good conscience. So we'll just take him down a notch or two. Then said Paul unto him, God shall smite thee, thou whited wall, for sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law? In other words, here you are. You're standing to try me by the law. But you're commanding something to be done that's contrary to the law. You're inconsistent. What do you think the expression whited wall might mean?
Seems the same thing that Jesus talked about in Matthew 23.
Whited sepulchres. Garnish the tombs. Make the outside look pretty, but the inside is corrupt.
Blow dead men's bones. I don't believe that's the strongest language he's used in. In fact, in his entire career that we know of.
Well, maybe unless it's that which might be comparable spoken to Sergius Paulus on the island of Cyprus.
Where he blinded him.
Yeah. All full of subtlety and guile.
Yeah.
He got a nerve there. He knew what he was shooting at, and he hit that target dead center. Mm-hmm. Because this man was a usurper, wasn't he? And he didn't respect him. He knew that he didn't have the right to that office.
That's one of two explanations. Now, for instance, verse 4, and they that stood by, revilest thou God's high priest? Then said Paul, I wist not, brethren, that is, I know not, that he was the high priest. Now, either Paul is saying that in a light of sarcasm, or it may well be that he didn't know that Ananias was the high priest. Now, Ananias is different. You see, back in earlier times, who were the high priests? You had two of them, one who was a high priest for the year, and then the other one who was his father-in-law, Annas and Caiaphas. And again, the process of weeks, I've forgotten which was which. Who was the father-in-law and who was the son-in-law? Caiaphas was the father-in-law? If you say so, we'll accept that. All right?
He wondered if Paul was so familiar with Sanhedrin he didn't know that this was the high priest.
Well, you see, Paul has been away for several years now, and he hasn't been associated with this Sanhedrin court very much.
That's a good question. Now, what time is this A.D. what?
Oh, I think you're getting pretty close to 60, 61. Let's say somewhere between 59 and 61.
Well, they had a line of succession there, and I think this thing had been disrupted, and Paul knew what that line was supposed to be, and this wasn't the man that's supposed to be in there, and so he either didn't recognize him because he wasn't familiar with him, or he had some supernatural knowledge there that this man was a usurper, and he gave him a full benefit. He knew what he was saying when he called him a white deceptive. Yeah. He was a hypocrite.
And if that were true, then of course what he said, I knewest not thou wert the high priest. I knewest not that he was the high priest, is said in sarcasm. In other words, you're not really the high priest. You don't have
your right. You don't act like him, and you're not.
Mm. Yeah, well, he might have, like the other Jews, knew the law and just didn't make a difference to him when he wanted to do something contrary to it. Now, history has it that this man later on was such an evil man, Ananias was such an evil man, that he was assassinated. That's how extremely evil he was. Then said Paul, verse 6, but when Paul perceived that one of the part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope of the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. Now, why would he say something like that?
Divided heart.
All right. Now, they've united in their efforts against Paul. Paul is a common enemy. Now, part of them are Sadducees and part of Pharisees. Paul says, I'm a Pharisee, and particularly in reference to the resurrection. Now, why am I called in question? Because of my teaching of the resurrection. Now, specifically of what resurrection? Christ's resurrection. That's the primary point he has in mind. And when he had said so, there arose a dissension, division amongst the Pharisees, or between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. Now they leave off fighting Paul, and they begin to fight amongst themselves, which was their common practice.
Were they not in the majority, because there's more Pharisees and Sadducees?
Yes.
So he not only had them divided, but he had the majority on his side.
That's right. And they are distracted somewhat from their persecution of Paul. Now, Luke qualifies it, he says, for the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. The Sadducees were materialists. They were living for this world and for this world now. Their religion had to deal with that, you see. They didn't believe anything after death, any spirit world or spirits or angels or anything else. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were with the Pharisees, or were of the Pharisees, part arose and strove, saying, we find no evil in this man. Why? He's a Pharisee. He's one of us, you see. He's part of our group. But if a spirit or an angel hath spoken to him, let us not fight against God. Now, they didn't believe that he spoke by God, but he was a Pharisee, and so this established some agreement. And when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down to take him by force from among them and to bring him into the castle. Now you see, Paul has been put down in the midst of the council amongst the Jews to give his defense. Claude wants to find out what this is all about. So when he begins and the uproar starts again, and he realizes that these men are in such a state of dissension and disagreement and hatred between themselves about this question that Paul is going to get torn apart. So he sends his men down a second time to rescue Paul. And the night following, the Lord stood by him, by Paul, and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." Now here is where Paul begins to understand what this is all about. Before, he's only known that he's going to go to Jerusalem, and there, when he gets there, that the Jews, that bonds await him, the Jews are going to deliver him to the Gentiles. But now God says to him, "Now, don't worry, Paul, because you've got something else to do, and that's to appear in Rome." And when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Now, that's a pretty strong vow to make. We're not going to eat a speck or drink a drop until Paul is dead. We're going to see that. And there were more than 40 which had made this conspiracy. There's the number, 40. And they came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great curse, that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. Now therefore, ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though ye would inquire something more perfectly concerning him." And what are they doing? Laying a plot.
Setting him up.
That's right. "And we, or even he come near, are ready to kill him." And when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. Now, isn't that interesting? There are a lot of things that we just don't know, you know, about the disciples and their kinfolks and who were their brethren, for instance. We wouldn't imagine this unless this context tells us. Paul's sister evidently had either believed in Christ or knew and had some acquaintance with Paul and what he taught and was concerned about Paul's welfare, knew what was going on. So Paul's nephew hears about this. So when he tells Paul, then verse 17, Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, "Bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath a certain thing to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, "Paul the prisoner called me unto him and prayed me to bring this young man unto thee, who hath something to say unto thee." Then the chief captain took him by the hand and went with him aside privately and asked him, "What is it that thou hast to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow unto the council," or into the council, "as though they would inquire something of him more perfectly." That is, that we want to hear more about what Paul has to say. "But do not thou yield unto them, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now are they ready, looking for a promise from thee." So the chief captain then let the young man depart and charged him, "See thou tell no man that thou hast showed these things to me." And he called unto him 2 centurions, saying, "Make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea." Now he's going to make sure that nothing's going to happen to Paul. Paul's a Roman.
He's evening up the odds just a little bit.
All right, you've got 200 men. Then horsemen, 70. How many is that? 70. That's another number. Spearmen, 200. Another number. At the third hour of the night. Another number. When's that?
9 o'clock
at night. All right, and provide them beasts that they may set Paul on and bring him safe unto Felix the governor. So let's get this thing in the hands where it belongs. Let Felix take care of it. And he wrote a letter after this manner. Now here's where you learn Claude's name. "Claudius Lysias, unto the most excellent governor Felix, sendeth greeting." Now you see how he is a politician, he's quite a diplomat. "Here I am, I'm writing to the most excellent Felix, and I send my greetings. This man was taken of the Jews, and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army and rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman."
It's a slight exaggeration, isn't it?
Boy, that's good, isn't it?
That might be a lie, but it is.
That's pretty good. Huh? That's verse 27. Now, that's really interesting. That's what I had reference to a moment ago. When did that man find out Paul was a Roman?
He was about to beat him. That's when he found out he was Roman. But he sure works it up a good case for Felix, you see. Now, I knew that Paul was a Roman, and I saw these Jews about to beat him, so I went down and saved him. He's a Roman.
You didn't let the facts mix him up.
It's unlikely that Felix ever found out anything.
Probably not. And when I would have known the cause whereof they accused him, I brought him forth into the council. Well, that's right. He wanted to know why they were trying to beat him. Whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law. He misses the point somewhat on that. But to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. Well, that's true. He hadn't done anything worthy of death, but they were about to kill him. And when it was told me how that the Jews laid wait for the man, I sent straightway to thee, and gave a commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell. We'll see you later. So this letter is sent with these centurions, the spearmen, the horsemen, and Paul's on his way to Caesarea to Felix. Now we'll let these people come up and they can state their case before Felix. He's the governor. Then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night unto Antipatris. That's the town on the way up there. Don't remember that. Might be a trick question on the test or something. They don't remember it. On the morrow, they left the horsemen to go with him and return to the council. In other words, they turned back. Who, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, I will hear thee, said he, when thine accusers are also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. So he put him away for a while. We're going to find in chapter 24 that the Jews are going to travel up here, Ananias, and they're going to bring with them a great orator. And they're going to try to bring their case against Paul in a fashion that's going to sway Felix and to get Paul released to them. So that's the beginning of chapter 24. Now, remember chapter 21 ends the third journey in Jerusalem. Then you have Paul going to the temple to keep and to fulfill the vow with the four men. As a result of this, his capture, they're trying to kill him. And when Claude sees he's a Roman, he goes down and takes him. So Claude says. That's what Claude said. Then he goes down and he takes him, and then his first defense, chapter 22. Chapter 22, remember that. Paul's first defense. What does he do? He starts from his birth. Goes back over his place of birth, his rearing, his background, his persecution of the church, his conversion. And then when he begins to talk about the Gentiles, that's it. Paul, you're not worthy to live. Cast their garments off and throw dust in the air and say, away with him, he's not worthy to live. And so, the next day, then Paul states his second defense, chapter 23. So chapter 22 and chapter 23 follow easily. Yes.
One question here. Paul said he was Roman. Was one he from Troas?
No, he was from Tarsus in Cilicia. This was a Roman city. A Roman city.
Roman city. His father was from Rome.
Did a service for the Roman government. So when Paul was, that made him a naturalized citizen, mm-hmm. I guess you'd say. And then Paul, when he was born, well, he was born a free Roman.
There were some cities that were recognized as being Roman cities. When a person was born of this city, then he was naturally a Roman citizen by natural birth, see, as opposed to buying it or it being given to him, military service, or being given to him for some special favor. Do you have any other questions?
Yeah, what's that to you at your birthplace? And why did Paul relay his birthplace?
To reach to these Jews, to show them that he was a Jew as well. You see, he had Jewish background, Jewish teaching. And then, like he did so many other times to begin with that, which established some rapport with them and some agreement and proceed on to something else. That was a reason for it. Now, you see, this material is not very difficult. We're just hitting spots and points, and that's all it is. But it's very interesting. I find it very interesting. Yeah, it's real easy. Even if you don't know it, you'll learn it. Any other questions? All right, now next week, we're going to cover to some degree chapter 24, 25, 26, 27, 28. Now, don't worry, because I'm not going to ask you to memorize Paul's journey, for instance, to Rome. Now, you've already covered some of it, but I want you to be generally familiar with the places. I'm not going to say now, tell me all the places Paul visited. I'm not going to ask you to do that. Specifically, when he sets sail, you know, and he sails over to the island of Crete, and then he's shipwrecked on the island of Malta, and then finally on to Rome, to specify all these places. I'm not going to ask you to do that. So don't worry too much about that. We'll cover these last chapters in a very brief way, like it is simply narrative, like most that we've talked about tonight, and nothing really doctrinal. The only thing we got in tonight that was doctrinal was the idea of the keeping of the customs of the law and the sacrifices and so forth in the temple in Jerusalem, chapter 21. Any questions before we close? Now's the time to ask them if you're confused about something.
How many of the feasts, how far did Paul go into observing feasts?
I don't know that he observed feasts.
Well, he wanted to get back by Pentecost.
Yeah.
It's running through my mind.
Yeah.
He wanted to get back to Jerusalem because Pentecost was going now.
Did he want to get back there to keep the feast, or did he?
I don't know, but
to meet all those people.
It may be that it was because those people were still, and he was using that like he used the synagogue and these other places merely to meet those people because they were already assembled.
There was a great door of refuge open unto him, those areas, places.
And the only trouble with that is he says in chapter 18 and verse 21, I must by all means keep this feast that cometh in Jerusalem. So he must have been keeping it to some degree. Yeah. He would not keep it, certainly as a religious act, I think.
He's in a limited sense.
To keep this feast, simply he could very well mean that he just wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily to keep it. Religious at all, but I want to be there, he said.
Mm-hmm.
One preacher, and I don't agree with him very much on this, teaches that Paul lived under the law for a while. I don't think he sustained.
I don't believe so.
But I heard him preach that. I've heard him preach it two or three times.
Well, some people take the position in reference to Paul going into the temple that he just didn't know any better yet. But he had already written Romans and Galatians. And his terminology there is very strong. He knows better. It's not a matter. In other words, if he taught, for instance, in Romans and Galatians, it's wrong to keep the law as a religious service to God. And then he went into the temple to keep the law in that respect. He would have been condemning himself. So there has to be some of the explanation for it. And that's the only one I know in reference to the customs. Circumcision and customs. All right. Anything else? I appreciate y'all being brave to come out tonight. Brave to try to study all this stuff.
That's the worst part, but that's better than what I have.
I think we could possibly justify Christmas to a certain degree in this same category.
As a non-religious act. Mm-hmm.
You know, some Christian, they don't think they ought to have any celebration, whatever.
Even say the word. Now, here's something else. If we can use the word Monday or Tuesday or Friday, especially Thursday.
Thursday.
We can use, because when we say that word, we don't have to go into a 500-word explanation of what we're talking about. We can just use the word and everybody knows what we're talking about. Now, I don't mean in a religious sense. I think that I understand everything that's taught there, and I don't think there's any way that we could justify any kind of special program, we'd say, as a religious service.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of family customs that we might have that are just traditions in our family. They have no religious significance at all, but at a certain time of the year, we do things. Well, we don't bind them on anybody else. We shouldn't. We can't. But
nor can you engage them as any kind of religious act,
right,
celebrating anything religious.
That's exactly right.
I've had some difficulty with this, and there was a time in my life in which I wouldn't do anything that was associated with what people customarily do at Christmas time. But I kind of swung back the other way to some degree, because I realize now that not all of these things have religious connotations. And maybe one time they did. In fact, all of the things that people do customarily now, in reference to Christmas, at one time had religious significance. But my problem was, they don't anymore. Giving gifts does not have within itself religious connotations. One time it did. A Christmas tree by and of itself does not have religious connotations. But one time it did. In fact, if you trace it back, it's in paganism. But this is an entirely different subject. But I do believe that there are some things that we can do that are a matter of custom as long as we keep them completely separated from religious connotation. Now, some things I still abstain from for the sake of influence, but I don't do in associating with Christmas for the sake of influence. Somebody might look at me and say, well, he's observing Christmas as a religious holiday, so I abstain from these things. There's a fine line there, and I realize it's a difficult line sometimes, but I think the principle may well be applicable.
The question is, where did we get this custom? That's the one it bugs.
Well,
over the many, many years.
We can't, it was a religious celebration.
It was at one time.
What about Thanksgiving? Thanksgiving was definitely a religious day. The pilgrims were thanking God that he preserved their lives instead of having a feast of abundance, as it is observed now. They had very little to eat, but they were so thankful for that they had a Thanksgiving with this very little.
We see the origin of something within itself does not make it wrong if it has lost that connotation of its origin.
It hasn't lost completely.
Well, that's the reason I said some things have not. That's the reason I abstain from some things, while there are other things that I will engage in which have completely lost religious connotation. And things that have religious connotation, I try to avoid altogether.
Christmas has lost it. Christmas lost it a long time ago. You got so many clergymen, and I'll put that quotation mark. You got so many clergymen that say, let's put Christ back into Christmas, which indicates that very widely in this country, Christ, as far as the masses are concerned, has taken Christ out of it, which is what they started with, but they've taken him out, as far as they're concerned. So it has lost its religion. It's mostly commercialized now.
I would be pleased if it would lose all of its religious connotations.
Just give it a little time. I think that's what it
is. Yeah. I'm not pleased that people will all take advantage of things, for instance, and commerce and things like this, and take advantage of time and situations. That doesn't please me.
I think you'll always have a few people who will continue to say, like Jim Bishop did in his column the other day, that Christmas Christ is worth that thing. You probably will never get away from that.
Now,
that's a part of it you probably will never lose.
I think the federal government will put it on Monday.
You can't tell. I don't want my children. I disapprove of them showing anything in which there's an association of religious things with this period of time. It's not wrong to sing that song anytime, but at this time, whenever they want to associate things like that with this period of time, that's the thing that makes a difference. Yeah, that's right. That's what they do. Nor would I allow my children to. I don't know. I haven't run into him.
But
I know him anyway.
What you
say, Christians that were allowing their children to sing these Christmas carols that deal with the Messiah and the birth of Christ and all these other things at the time, supposedly Christ's birthday.
Well, the choir here is actually singing the Messiah.
I didn't know that. We got kind of sidetracked there for a moment.
I'm
going
to get off.
But I don't think that if they had prayer.
Well, there's some inconsistencies in what the school does and doesn't do, really. They are. The problem, of course, that we all have as parents is that our children are constantly subjected to policies of the school and practices of the school, which normally the accepted denominational world goes right along with and is completely involved in. And they think, therefore, that all the children ought to go right along with all of these without any question at all. And it presents hardships for children who are coming on. Because they are subjected to ridicule and other things by their classmates, and they don't understand everything that's going on. But it's not a matter of people not believing in the birth of Christ, because we know that we believe in the birth of Christ. It's not a matter of people being unsocial, because I'll do anything in the world I can that is in accord with community that's social as long as it doesn't involve religious practices that are wrong. But the issue is in practicing something in a religious nature for which there's no authority. So we therefore cannot involve ourselves in religious practices at this time of the year, which would in any way celebrate the birthday of Christ. This isn't the birthday of Christ. Never was, never has been, and never is any scriptural authority for celebrating the birthday of Christ at all.
I work with an Orthodox Jew. Of course, he doesn't observe Christmas.
You don't have any problem there, do you?
And he is surprised at the position that we take on that. He thinks that's right, because we're not agreeing with him. We're just both disagreeing with him.
Protestantism.
But Tim, didn't Christmas originally, the exchanging of gifts going to go back to the wise men and people brought gifts to Christ? Was this what how the custom was supposed to have started?
Well, supposedly that's how it got started. But you see, what man has done when it was first being celebrated, when Christmas was first being celebrated, it was celebrated by Catholicism, by the Catholic Church. They were the ones who instituted it. Then there were incorporated in this particular celebration, this time of celebration, different things. Some of them were pagan in origin. Some of them were supposed to go back to the practices of New Testament time, you see. Like I said, the tree actually is pagan in origin, and it originated from the Norwegian countries who worshipped fertility and the green tree, the evergreen tree. So to them, this was a type of goddess worship, god worship of the trees. So they would erect these trees, and they would put apples and oranges and all these things on the trees. What did those signify? To us today, they don't signify anything. But to those people, it again signified the idea of fertility and of abundance. And it was almost a type of idolatry. But this was incorporated. There's several different things that were incorporated into this time that's called Christmas. Through the passing of years, certain traditions were involved in it, you see. And the little star or a picture of baby Jesus put on the top of the tree. All these things have connotations. Now, we don't see it now because it's lost a lot of its connotation. But from here and there and everywhere, these things were incorporated into what became a Catholic feast day of Christmas.
When did Santa Claus get in?
St. Nicholas. Yep. From a particular saint who was supposed to have been benevolent to children and giving gifts to children. This very likely is where this practice of giving gifts came from, rather than from the time that the men took the gifts of Christ.
Did you watch that special program on television?
You have an addition. You have
exactly where you came.
You have an addition. You have an addition this year. Something that's new. And that's Mrs. Santa Claus.
Mrs. Santa Claus.
Yeah. She was on that
today. And she's dressed up in the same attire, same color.
Well, you see, that's the reason I say most of this is losing its religious connotation. It's losing its religious connotation.
Yeah, right.
So 1,000 years from now, the kids be reading about what those fellows did way back 2,000 years ago at Mr. Mrs. Santa Claus.
Do you normally think about when you say Santa Claus, do you think of a saint, a Catholic saint?
I don't.
But that's where he originated, you see.
That's where you're thinking of it. All right, too much.
Yes.
Yeah, but this is already, Christmas is already lost so much of its religious
significance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going back to this Messiah now. Why couldn't this be on the same order as people that put up Christmas tree? It's already lost its Christian religious significance. So this could be.
But you see, the problem is that they are associating Christ with this time. Now, as long as they disassociate Christ with the time, that's fine. If you want to sing a song about the weather and Christmas and happy time and gifts and all these other stuff, you see, that's fine. White Christmas, jingle bells.
Well, I thought most people at one time or other associated Christmas with this, like I mentioned earlier.
With Christ's birthday? A lot of religious people do. That's what I want to try to get them not to do. I want them to disassociate it.
Yeah. No, I know that, but if it's the same Messiah that, like you said, more or less celebrates Christmas, would be the same if it's office of Christmas.
You see, by singing that song, you're associating religious things with Christmas by singing that song, you see. Like, if you're going to sing a song in a party celebration that deals with the birthday of Christ. You see what you're doing? You're associating a religious thing with the time of the season. Now, the thing that I say that we need to do is to disassociate them altogether. Forget about the whole concept that men say this is Christ's birthday. It's not Christ's birthday. In fact, scripturally, it cannot be celebrated as Christ's birthday at all.
But the world looks at it as Christ's birthday.
Many of the world do. Not all of the world, but many of the world
most
do.
Most of it does. Well, I thought nearly everybody associated Christmas with religion. I always had.
Yeah. I did too for a long time. And most people do for a long time. Until you begin to wake up. Where does the Bible in any way mention, you know, an idea of celebrating Christ's birthday? Not there.
Well,
driving an automobile is not a religious act. It's not an act of worship to God.
You know, most scholars believe Christ was born in the fall. Shepherds were in the field.